Before we begin, Wichita, Denver, Boston, I see you out there, and I appreciate your support. Now, on with the episode. Welcome back to Washington Madison 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. It is time to get in what I'm getting on, talk about what I'm reading about, and get through some recent articles that I have been muddling or pondering or thinking about that have come across my desk. So without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bilt 2020, Questioning Medicine. Let's do this thing. And without any further ado, the first article we're going to talk about is comparative effectiveness of antibiotic treatment duration in children with pyelonephritis. This was in JAMA May 1st, 2020, and it looked at pyelonephritis and how long should we give the antibiotics. You see, typically guidelines, they recommend 10 to 14 days. And why do they recommend 10 to 14 days? Well, it's very simple, because we have 10 fingers and there are 14 days and 2 weeks, and that is all the science you really need. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's 13 days, because 13 days isn't a nice, even, wonderful number. It doesn't matter if the answer is 9 days, because, well, we have more than 9 fingers, so we can't possibly stop at 9 days. In this study, they looked at almost 800 children ages 6 months to 18 years with pyelonephritis who received a short course of antibiotics, which was considered less than 10 days, or a prolonged course of antibiotics, which was considered greater than or equal to 10 days of antibiotics. In total, about 63% of the individuals received a prolonged course of antibiotics with a median duration of 11 days. The median duration of the short course was 8 days, so 3 fewer days of antibiotics, which is significant, probably both clinically and statistically. I mean, clinically, 3 more days of antibiotics is 3 more days of antibiotics, and there are likely going to be some sort of harms if you multiply that over a large mass, such as, oh, I don't know, the American or U.S. population of children that have pyelonephritis, but I digress. The rates of treatment failure, though, were absolutely no different. There was no statistical difference between the short and prolonged courses of antibiotics in their rates of treatment failure. Over and over, antibiotics have been found to be these magical things that we magically prescribe for a magical duration of time. They are magical in the sense that they actually do kill bacteria. It's pretty amazing when you really think about it, what they can do. But the duration for which we give antibiotics is far from magical and usually far from scientific. And speaking of magical, people will do almost any stupid little dog and pony trick that you can talk them into in the whole world if you can get rid of their pain, in particularly their knee pain. The better brain has occasional leg pain from a skiing injury, and I am one of the most scientific, data-driven individuals you will ever meet in your entire life. But when she has leg pain, I will tell you, I myself will resort to almost anything, including fairy dust. But she would never wear ugly shoes, so I personally have never looked into APOS therapy, APOS. If you are not driving right now, pull this up on your phone, APOS therapy. They are shoes that are supposed to help with your knee arthritis. And these shoes are super ugly. They look like old school Converse high tops with these little half semicircular balls that goes under the ball of your foot and another half semicircular ball that goes under your heel, and you're supposed to be able to adjust these little wedges so that way it releases the pain on your knee and makes it so you can walk easier, and then it gets rid of your knee pain, and bada boom, bada bing, your knee pain is gone. Well, they looked at this very mechanism in a study titled Effective Biomechanical Footwear on Knee Pain in People with Knee Osteoarthritis, the BioTalk Randomized Clinical Trial. This is in JAMA May 12th, and they looked to see if this specific biomechanical APOS footwear therapy could help osteoarthritis knee pain. In total, there were 220 patients, and they were randomized to either this APOS therapy or a control. Now, the control footwear also had these little ugly things that you put on the outside of the shoe that you walked on. However, you couldn't adjust them to relieve any pressure points in the knee, and that is how they kept this study pretty much blinded, which was a really cool thing. In the end, they looked to see the improvement on the Lower Western Ontario and McMaster University Osteoarthritis Index Pain Subscore. Whew! That's a whole mouthful, but basically the Western Ontario Osteoarthritis Pain Scale for osteoarthritis is a very validated scale, and they were looking to see the improvement here on the subscore. So in the end, I will tell you that the APOS therapy people, the APOS, APOS people are going to be thrilled with the results because there was decrease in the pain scale at 24 weeks. In fact, there was a greater decrease in the real thing than in the control, and it was statistically significant. At 24 weeks of follow-up, the mean standardization of the WOMAC pain subscore improved from 4.3 to 1.3 in this APOS therapy footwear group, and from 4.0 to 2.6 in the control footwear group. It went down in both groups, but it went down by a greater amount in the APOS therapy. In the active arm, it went down by 1.3 points on a 10-point scale. However, the listeners of my show, the listeners of Questioning Medicine, will likely say to themselves, wait a second, are you meaning to tell me that a change of 1.3 points on a 10-point scale is what I'm actually supposed to care about? Is that really clinically significant? Well, I would argue, of course not. It is very hard for me to tell if there is a true difference in a pain score of 7 out of 10 or 6 out of 10, 5 out of 10 or 6 out of 10. It is very difficult to tell. In fact, I don't think there is significance because I find it so hard to tell that to me it is truly 6 one way, half a dozen the other. I will tell you that in reading this trial, the shoe company will say that this is a positive trial because it found a positive outcome and those who are wearing the shoe are doing the right thing. Or I will also tell you that those individuals who were not wearing the shoe before this, who didn't believe in the shoe before this, will continue not to believe in the shoe because although it is a quote-unquote positive, a statistically positive study, there is really likely no clinical difference here. But in a world where a patient is in pain and you can't give them a placebo drug, you can't give them a placebo injection, and you cannot give them placebo shoes, it is possible that these shoes are a solution. They did decrease the pain score, even if it was just psychological, which really all pain is just psychological in one way or another. I mean, sure, there is some anatomical variation to it, but a lot of it is psychological. If we can prescribe these shoes and they don't have to go on opioids or have to forego surgery, or they can forego surgery, then I think that this is a positive, even though clinically, this is really probably a negative. That's my opinion. What say you? As I mentioned in the last podcast, I love any study out there that sets out to answer one simple question and can actually answer that one simple question. Well, that was seen in this study titled Effective Surgery versus Functional Bracing on Functional Outcome Among Patients with Closed Displaced Humeral Shaft Fractures, the FISH Randomized Clinical Trial. This study looked to see, if you have a displaced closed humerus shaft fracture, can you just put it in a brace or do you need to go in and open it up? Do you need a surgeon or just someone who knows how to make a really good cast? More and more surgeons are going in and they're closing these things up open, even though it is a closed fracture. So, are they doing it based on evidence or are they doing it based on the dollar bills, y'all? Well, the answer was among patients with closed humeral shaft fracture, internal fixation surgery compared with non-operative functional bracing did not significantly improve functional outcomes at 12 months. I will warn you, this was only 82 people in the study, and 30% of those randomized to undergoing bracing eventually switched over to the surgery arm. In fact, only about 80% of the people finished the study based on the pre-protocol analysis, and surgery was also associated with an increase in the nerve palsy, increase in repeat surgery. And this is another thing that is probably six one way, half a dozen the other in the end, but why in the world would you ever want to undergo surgery if you didn't have to? It just seems crazy to me. So if this is my humerus, if this is my closed displaced humerus shaft fracture, go ahead and put me in a brace. Go ahead and brace me up. And then if I really need it, I'll be willing to undergo surgery in the future. But don't send me there to begin with, because for me, the harm is a lot greater with surgery than it is with a little brace. And there is no difference at functional outcomes at 12 months. And speaking of harms, what about the harms of antibiotics? I've talked about it on Questioning Medicine before, but let's look at it again in this paper in JAMA Pediatrics titled Adverse Events of Antibiotics Used to Treat Acute Otitis Media in Children, a Systematic Meta-Analysis. And they looked to see how often do children experience adverse effects from antibiotics used to treat otitis media. They looked at diarrhea, generalized rash, diaper rash, and candida dermatitis in children treated with amoxicillin, Augmentin, azithromycin, ceftonir, and placebo for otitis media. One of the things that I really liked that they did was they looked at placebo, because although we talk about the effects of antibiotics, you have to remember these kids are sick. They have some sort of viral illness going on. So we can't just say, oh, well, look at that. The antibiotic that made them have a 50% rate of diarrhea. Well, maybe they had 50% rate of diarrhea, but maybe placebo, just them being sick, just them having a viral illness, they were going to have a 45% rate of diarrhea on placebo, on just giving them nothing. And the wonderful thing about kids is that most kids are so little when they're in these trials, months old, 1 year old, 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, they don't know the difference between placebo and real drug. They just know they're getting some sort of medication. But the actual cognitive bias for which they are in the trial is really not up to them. It might be up to the parents. The parents might say, oh, look, my kid's actually getting a real medication. But a five-year-old knows no difference. A five-year-old doesn't really care. A five-year-old just knows that they feel really crummy. And that's the beautiful thing about the innocence of children in studies. Unfortunately, we just don't have a lot of good studies with little children. But back to the study at hand. Diarrhea was the most common adverse event. It ranged from just about 2% with azithromycin, up to almost 20% with Augmentin. But the placebo caused diarrhea in almost 7% of the children, which will likely, or does likely, reflect the underlying viral infections that these children have. Things like diaper rash, well, diaper rash is pretty much one of those things that placebo doesn't really have a lot of, and they didn't find a whole lot of reporting on placebo with diaper rash. However, diaper rash occurred in about 5% of the children overall and up to 15% of children that were given Augmentin. In the end, it's just a reminder that antibiotics have an effect, and realistically, in developed nations, the harm of antibiotics outweighs the benefit for a majority of reasons that we use them in. Realistically, we are causing harm up to 20% of the time, diarrhea, almost 15 to 20% of the time. 20% is just a good thing to keep in your head. 20% of the time, diarrhea. 20% of the time, diaper rash. Those are the harms. And while placebo will give you some harms too, it's a lot less. And if you're not giving them anything at all, well, that is a lot less than giving them a drug that realistically is probably not helping them. And speaking of drugs that are not helping them, I will end this podcast with one more article. So sound the horn, get ready to set that ship a sail. And we are going to end this podcast with a little prescription description. So here we go. Alrighty, I have done prescription descriptions before, and I will try to do more of them because I think, for me, they're kind of fun. You look at a medication that's getting prescribed, and then you look at the evidence around it, and you say, is this worth it? Is this a drug that if I were in the FDA, if I were part of the FDA, that I would allow on to market for the outcomes that it wants? Is it worth it? Is it worth it going to market? Well, the FDA approved bempedoic acid, which cost around $333 a month on GoodRx, and it is used to help lower LDL cholesterol in adults with familial hypercholesterolemia or established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease for whom statins are deemed insufficient. In phase 3 studies, which included just over 3,000 patients, once daily bempedoic acid was superior to placebo with a mean correction of 18% in the LDL reduction in those that took the bempedoic acid compared to placebo. The manufacturer does note that when you're on bempedoic acid, the uric acid level should be monitored in those taking bempedoic acid, as you are in increased risk for gout, and the drug has been associated with a tendon rupture and should not be used in patients with prior tendon disorders. Bempedoic acid effects on the cardiovascular morbidity or mortality are unknown, says the manufacturer. And in a randomized controlled trial from 2019, there was a study that looked at what was the effect of bempedoic acid in addition to statins among patients with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, familial hypercholesterolemia, or both for the outcome of cardiovascular disease mortality, all-cause mortality, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, major adverse cardiovascular events, or any one of those events individually. That is a huge composite outcome. When you throw in mortality, all-cause mortality, any kind of mortality, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, fatal stroke, non-fatal stroke, major adverse cardiovascular event, admission to hospital, you throw in everything. When you're throwing in the whole bucket and you add it all together, you're hoping to find something. Except there was no difference, zero, zippo, zilcho difference between bempedoic acid and placebo. But to be fair, they weren't really looking for a change because the follow-up was 12 months and there were low event rates, meaning the patients were healthy at baseline. When you don't have a lot of events, it means that the patients are healthy. I am a relatively healthy 33-year-old male. I don't have a lot of events of cardiovascular events because I'm healthy. I don't expect to. But if you would have enrolled high-risk individuals, I don't know, 82-year-old male with comorbid conditions, well, then at 1 year, you actually might have seen a difference. But that's not who you enrolled because you didn't actually want to find a difference. You just wanted to get your drug approved by the FDA. In fact, not only is there no difference in the things that I care about between bempedoic acid and placebo, evidence suggests a possible harm with bempedoic acid with a non-significant trend towards higher cardiovascular disease, 0.4% versus 0.1%, and all-cause mortality, 0.9% versus 0.3%. And yes, I know, evidence doesn't work that way. When the numbers are non-significant, then the statistics are non-significant. You can't say, well, it's not statistically significant, but it is almost kind of statistically significant. You can't say that. I get it. I understand it. In fact, it's one of my bigger pet peeves. However, I will tell you that I would like to see them be equal or really close, or at least 0.9% versus 0.3%. That's three times the difference. Again, it's on a small scale, but when you have not very many events because you enrolled healthy people, I would expect them to be almost identical. When you randomize it, it should be randomized almost identical because it's random. So for me, when you can't prove real benefit, and in the phase 3 study, the best you can show is a 18% change in an outcome, LDL, that I don't really care about, with an, although not statistically significant, but 3 to 4-fold increase in cardiovascular events and all-cause mortality compared to placebo, I will tell you that for me, this drug is a no thank you at all. But I will thank you for listening to Questioning Medicine. And before I wrap this up, I will say, if you learned anything, please pass it on to a friend, a colleague, someone you work with, or that individual that you talk about your weird or odd cases with. And if you have any questions, you can always email me, AndrewBuelt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. And now with that, let's wrap this thing up and go over the articles I talked about in 30 seconds or less. Here we go. Article number one was comparative effectiveness of antibiotic treatment duration in children with pyelonephritis. What do you know? Less than 10 days did better than greater than 10 days. The median here was 8 days, but I think this just goes to show that antibiotics are magical and they kill bacteria, but the number of days for which we write them for are far from magical. Speaking of magic, if some ugly shoes on your feet will get your pain score for your knee osteoarthritis from a 4 down to a 1, I'm all on board with that, even if that means that it didn't really clinically beat placebo. Unfortunately, I can't prescribe placebo ugly shoes for you to wear. So if this works for your patients, I'm all on board for it. It's got to be better than surgery. It's got to be better than getting your patient hooked on opioids. It's got to be better. So with that, I would say if it was me and I really needed something, I was in a pinch in a bind, I'd wear these ugly things and I'd wear them with pride. APOS therapy, APOS therapy. And if it is my humerus fracture that is closed, then go ahead and put in a brace. Do not let me go to surgery right away. There's probably no difference in function at 12 months, but if I'm having a limited amount of function early on, I have no problem switching over to surgery once bracing fails. And speaking of failing, what about failing our antibiotic stewardship that we have set forward? Go forward and do not prescribe the antibiotics, he said. And that was clearly seen in the Journal of Pediatrics. Amoxicillin, Augmentin, Azithromycin, we're looking at rates of diarrhea up around 20%, rates of diaper rash up around 15%+. These are huge numbers that when realistically the little Susie sitting in front of you doesn't need an antibiotic, well, they probably don't need an antibiotic and they also don't need the side effects that come from the antibiotic. And last but not least, bempedoic acid. It is now on the market. It is to be used for individuals with familial hypercholesterolemia. It is to be used with individuals with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease in whom statins are deemed insufficient. I will tell you, insufficient is a term meaning you couldn't get your LDL lower. And in the study, they were able to find a mean 18% lower LDL reduction compared to placebo. However, there was no change in the major cardiovascular events, mainly because realistically, they weren't looking for it. They enrolled healthy people for 1 year and said, oh, no difference, nothing to see here, and wrapped up their trial. But when you really dug into the numbers, it was trending towards worst with bempedoic acid. I'm not going to be prescribing this. No way, no how, not anytime soon. You may prescribe it if you'd like. If you believe in it, I get it. Maybe you're going to have a drug rep coming in your office trying to pitch this thing and get you to use it. Because at $330 a month, you don't have to sell very many prescriptions before you've recouped your losses. And then you're just sitting on pure profit. Pure profit off of an 18% drop in the LDL and no change in the cardiovascular events. And with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every single podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.